On this week's On the Media, the changing face of the all-powerful prosecutor.
The DA is even more powerful than judges, criminal defense attorneys, probation, the governor, the mayor, anyone.
Prosecutors were the good guys, the knights in shining armor.
And then you also see yourself as being the force of righteousness. Are you going to start to cut corners?
The notion that any particular police commissioner, mayor, or DA is going to beat their chest for a minute and all of a sudden crime is going to stop is just a fiction. It's a bunch of nonsense.
I think in a rash dash to whet the appetite of those who are clamoring for criminal justice reform, they've gone too far, and I think society's going to suffer.
How can we believe that the system is fair if I'm going to investigate myself if I do something wrong, and I'm operating essentially in a cloak of darkness?
Once it was about lock 'em up, now it's about ending mass incarceration. It's all coming up.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out just one more week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this clearly has been the week of the prosecutor.
You made a decision not to prosecute, correct?
No, we made a decision not to decide whether to prosecute or not.
Why did we have all of this investigation of President Trump that the other side is talking about when you knew that you weren't going to prosecute him?
Well, you don't know where the investigation is going to lie, and the OLC opinion itself says that you can continue the investigation even though you are not going to indict the president.
Once again, those who cherished the belief in salvation through Robert Mueller were deflated when he didn't save the republic. Yet it's an American article of faith that saving us is what a prosecutor does. In fact, many prosecutors, apparently not Mueller, themselves believe that that is what they do. This week, one of them died at the age of 99, Robert Morgenthau, chief federal prosecutor for Southern New York State for 9 years and Manhattan's hard-as-nails DA for 35. Here he is in 1983 when crime was soaring.
There's a lot of pressure on you all the time.
There's a lot of, and it's hard to plan your time because people commit crimes every day of the week. The arraignment courts run 24 hours a day now in Manhattan.
Street crime was still something that people worried about day in and day out.
Elliot Spitzer served 6 years as a prosecutor in the Manhattan DA's office under Morgenthau, and 8 years from 1999 to 2006 as state attorney general himself, where he earned the moniker Sheriff of Wall Street for his corruption probes of the financial industry. Then he was elected governor, but resigned a year in after a prostitution scandal. He knows a thing or two about public image, especially the image of prosecutors in the good old bad days of raging crime.
Prosecutors were the good guys, making the streets safe, both from the ordinary street crime, robberies and the theft of radios out of cars, to homicides and rape, to organized crime that was viewed at least as controlling the fish market, concrete, trucking in the garment district, which is the case I made. So we were the good guys back then, restoring order to what was viewed as an orderless society.
But the zealous Morgenthau was slammed for brushing off police corruption, racial bias, police brutality. After 5 years in Morgenthau's office, the young lawyer Sonia Sotomayor concluded that the DA's lock-em-up derring do was misguided. We think we're keeping the people safe from criminals, she said. We're just making worse criminals. So now the new faith is in electing a new kind of DA, the progressive prosecutor, whose programs safeguard public safety by supporting communities by reducing mass incarceration while saving heaps of money. It's happening in Philadelphia.
The cash bail system keeps broke people in jail because they're broke.
And that's a problem.
In Chicago,
the incumbent has had 7 years to make justice reform, you know, a reality here in Cook County. We've not done that.
In Boston,
what I'm saying is jail is a last resort with respect to these 15 misdemeanors that are nonviolent, more quality of life crimes.
In St. Louis, Kansas City, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and elsewhere, it's a movement generating passion and support all across the political spectrum. The stunningly powerful and radically changing role of the DA is the subject of this hour. One presidential candidate has been eager to wear the label of the progressive prosecutor.
As a prosecutor, my duty was to seek and make sure that the most vulnerable and voiceless among us are protected.
But with a mixed record as a former San Francisco DA and Attorney General of California,
to reform the criminal justice system, understanding that it is deeply flawed and in need of repair.
She's having some trouble making it stick.
When she decided to run for president, Kamala Harris wrote a memoir. And in that memoir, she described herself as a progressive prosecutor. And she talked about the importance of racial justice and social justice and being on the right side of history.
Lara Bassalon is a law professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law and former director of the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent in Los Angeles. She recently wrote an op-ed titled, Kamala Harris Was Not a Progressive Prosecutor.
We have a very problematic history in this country, particularly of locking up disproportionately people who are of color, people who are poor, innocent people. And she specifically referenced that. And it riled me up because as someone who's represented those people my whole life against prosecutors just like her, I understand that she's actually been on the wrong side of that history.
One of her most widely criticized policies is one that she's boasted about, prosecuting parents whose children are habitually truant in elementary school.
Yes. Its idea is to end habitual or chronic truancy by penalizing the parents. And the thought is it incentivizes them to get it together and make sure their kids go to school. But the law has been widely criticized because, first of all, the only people who get caught up in this are, once again, poor people in communities of color. And second of all, how helpful is it really to separate families that are pretty clearly in distress?
When a bill came up requiring the investigation of officer-involved shootings, she opposed that.
There was a lot of protest from people who actually had formerly been her allies, both in the Black Legislative Caucus and also Black Lives Matter activists, when she did not support a bill demanding that her office investigate police-involved shootings.
What was her position on the death penalty?
When she first assumed office as district attorney in San Francisco, there was a case where a police officer had been shot and killed, and she had run on a platform of not seeking the death penalty, and she didn't seek the death penalty in that case. And she got a tremendous amount of blowback from politicians like Dianne Feinstein, who basically called her out at the officer's funeral, and other law enforcement figures in the state. Then you fast forward to when she is attorney general, and she won her initial run by less than 1% of the vote. It was a very, very close election, and she did not have the support of major law enforcement groups. At that point, during her tenure, there was a judge in Southern California who found the death penalty to be unconstitutional. And it was her decision whether to defend the law or whether to agree with that judge. And she chose to defend the death penalty and successfully argued for it to remain in place in California.
You say, though, that the worst thing about her record as a prosecutor are her decisions on wrongful conviction cases.
I'm someone who spent part of my career advocating for people who've been wrongfully convicted. And I can tell you that the biggest barrier as the attorney can often be the prosecutor just doubling and tripling down on these false convictions and refusing to admit that they were wrong to the point of denying the victim's justice and stealing somebody's life. And so when you see somebody in the position of the attorney general repeatedly defending these tainted convictions, knowing that harm and that damage and that drastic unfairness, that does seem to me to be the most problematic part of her record.
And in your column, you talk about George Gage, you talk about Daniel Larson and Kevin Cooper.
This is an infamous case in California. Kevin Cooper was convicted of murdering a family. He's African American. The family was white. It was an absolutely horrific murder. He always claimed to be innocent. there are all kinds of really powerful discrepancies in the evidence, and the trial was incredibly racialized. There were signs outside saying, hang the N-word. Post-conviction, it turned out that all kinds of lies had been told and evidence had been suppressed. And Kevin Cooper, after his appeals had been exhausted and hours away from execution, and had had a number of judges say, we think that this man may actually be innocent, asked the attorney general, who was then Kamala Harris, to order DNA testing, and she refused. And then when Jerry Brown was leaving office late last year, he did order certain items to be retested. And this was after Nicholas Kristof, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, wrote this viral expose of the case. And after Jerry Brown issued that order, our new governor, Gavin Newsom, issued an even wider-ranging order. And when Nicholas Kristof went back to Kamala Harris, she reversed position and said she now did support DNA testing for Kevin Cooper, even though she had previously opposed it. Of course, now she's not in a position to be granting it or not granting it.
When I think about the old style prosecutor and the progressive kind, I think that it's about where you set your target. Do you set your target on someone with little power or on someone with greater power?
I think she was a very traditional prosecutor. When she had a case to make against someone powerful or someone not powerful, she made it. When she could act in a way that was not going to get her on the wrong side of very powerful law enforcement groups, then she acted in accordance with that goal. And that's really no different than the vast majority of prosecutors. The problem for her is that she's saying she was different when she wasn't.
Laura, thank you very much.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Laura Bassalon is a law professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Coming up, how prosecutors replaced public defenders as heroes of the public imagination. This is On the Media. This is Brooke. When you finish listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? My colleague David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie.
This is the only idea I've ever had for a film.
Really?
I never get asked to do a film.
Really?
Never.
You know, you really should listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So please, do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is Joe Biden in June on the debate stage in a smackdown with Kamala Harris.
I was a public defender. I didn't become a prosecutor. I came out, I left a good law firm to become a public defender, when in fact...
Biden was hearkening back to the era not so long ago when the prosecutor was not seen as the predominant defender of the American way. After all, it was the public defender who protects the rights of the poor, of the unpopular, even the guilty. Prosecutors prosecuted.
Historically, prosecutors have won re-election by promising to be as tough on crime as possible.
That's Emily Bazelon. We just heard from her sister. Staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and author of Charged, the New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration.
You just couldn't lose by beating the law and order drum.
Before the 21st century, though prosecutors safeguarded the public in their fashion, defense attorneys were often more admired as protectors of the underdog.
Abraham Lincoln did criminal defense work. And so then when you get to the mid-20th century in the 50s and 60s, we have the fictional character of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is.
We had TV's Perry Mason.
And you didn't plant Fallon's note in his pocket?
No!
No, Mr. Nichols. You didn't kill Thompson. But you did, Mr. Wells.
I think there was just more cultural recognition of the job of the defense lawyer.
Then let's get to an entire generation, beginning in 1990, Law and Order, the small screen expression of an era already underway.
Where there's a law, I'll enforce it. Where there's a crime, I'll prosecute it. And where there's a victim, I'll speak for that victim. That's my bottom line.
Right. Our heroes are the people who are prosecuting the crimes. That was also a good fit with what was happening in that moment. You know, starting in the late 70s and the 80s, we have a rise in crime that scares a lot of people. And we start to see politicians, you know, really beginning with Richard Nixon, winning office by promising to be as tough as possible. And the other thing that's particularly true on television and in the media is we lift up the trial. Even though, starting in the 80s, the trial begins to vanish from the reality of the American criminal justice system. It's almost as if we're more attached to the trial on television, the less people actually experience it in reality.
That factoid in your book really just stopped me in my tracks, that 95% of decisions are made in plea bargains and never get to the bench.
And what's going on here is prosecutors growing in power. What you see in the 80s, when there is this rising crime, are tougher sentences.
The states need to match tougher federal laws with tougher laws of their own.
George H.W. Bush.
Stiffer bail, probation, parole, and sentencing.
And one of the main mechanisms for making sentences harsher was the mandatory minimum sentence. Tie the hands of a softy judge and make sure that this person is going to prison for a certain amount of time. The goal was to eliminate discretion. But the problem is you can't eliminate discretion from the criminal justice system.
Discretion moved from the judge to the prosecutor.
Exactly. The dual role of the prosecutor is that they are supposed to both focus on winning convictions and also being ministers of justice because they represent the state and the court. The problem is that winning convictions can very much take over. Some prosecutors' offices have traditionally given out awards when you put someone away. I think it is also true that if you get used to seeing yourself as wearing a white hat, you can lose sight of other kinds of values and of your own fallibility. And so if you have a lot of power and then you also see yourself as being the force of righteousness, are you going to start to cut corners? Are you going to think, okay, well, I know this person is guilty, so maybe I'll withhold some evidence of their innocence? The problem of believing that the ends justify the means.
There's a history of prosecutorial digging in. There's one case you describe. A guy is sent up the river for rape. Then through DNA evidence, they find the actual rapist. They try him. They throw him in the clink, but they won't let the first guy go.
That was a really shocking case for me as well. It involves a defendant named Joe Buffy, and it took place in a small town in West Virginia. You know, it's so important to say, like, most prosecutors would never do something like this. But sometimes you get people who are just so self-righteous or so unwilling to imagine the harm they've done by putting an innocent person in prison that they're just not willing to back down. And that is certainly what happened in Joseph Buffy's case. The West Virginia Supreme Court overturned his conviction, and the prosecutors just insisted, well, even though the DNA evidence implicates someone else, and we actually caught that guy who had a record as a sex offender, we're now going to concoct some accessory role in this crime for Joseph Buffy, even though the victim never said there was a second person present.
I was actually shocked by the lack of oversight, all the battles lost in the effort to impose some oversight on district attorneys.
In the 1970s, the Supreme Court has this question, what kind of immunity from suit should a prosecutor have? And they pick the very highest level. It's called absolute immunity. And it basically means that if you can say that what you did wrong was in the course of doing your job, you're not going to be personally sued. Prosecutors can do things like not disclose or even deliberately hide evidence and very rarely get punished. Nobody in our system should have that kind of ability to abuse the system.
You get to investigate yourself if you need to be investigated.
Hey, Massachusetts, here's a pop quiz. Who's the most powerful person in the criminal legal system? No, it's not a judge. It's your local district attorney, your DA. What makes your DA so powerful? For one, they decide who gets charged with a crime. But more importantly, they determine how most criminal cases are resolved. And in Massachusetts, 90% of criminal cases are resolved by plea bargaining. In many instances, judges have almost no role in the plea bargaining process.
the plea bargain is the grease that keeps the wheels of the system spinning.
I think a lot of people would be inclined to think, why would someone plead guilty to a serious crime that they didn't commit?
You can feel coerced or forced into pleading guilty because if you decide that you want to go to trial, the penalty will be so much higher than the offer the prosecutor is making. For example, there's a man in prison in Louisiana prosecuted by the New Orleans DA's office, which is one of the offices that historically has had this problem of hiding evidence, arrested for a robbery at gunpoint. Offered a 15-year plea deal if he pled guilty. He said he didn't do it. It's a pretty shaky victim ID. There's no other physical evidence against him. He decided to roll the dice and go to trial, and he is serving a 65-year sentence. This is someone who was 19 and who had one prior drug crime on his record.
In 2012, you found the average sentence for federal narcotics defendants who entered a plea was 5 years and 4 months. The average sentence for defendants who went to trial was 16 years.
Right. So I would argue there's something wrong there because the people who went to trial and the people who pled guilty, one group is not necessarily more culpable or more dangerous than the other group. You're really talking about the kind of pressure that the system exerts on defendants in order for the system to keep functioning at a fast rate.
Let's talk about bail, because a lot of progressive prosecutors in this recent wave are focused on that system.
Arguably the best and most successful zero money bail system is Washington, D.C., which has been working that way for 30 years.
Larry Krasner is Philadelphia DA's and a resolutely progressive prosecutor.
It's illegal under D.C. law to have money be any aspect of bail. So they only have two speeds on the car. One speed is you get released. Maybe there's some conditions. And the other speed is that there's no amount of bail you can pay to get out. What that really works out to in Washington, D.C. is about 12% are held without bail.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are Mark Zuckerberg and you are charged with something, you're not getting out because no amount of money will get you out.
I just wondered whether most Americans still see prison as a first resort, the safest approach.
When you look at polls that ask people, are you more likely to vote for a candidate who's interested in reducing mass incarceration or increasing racial fairness in the system? The majority of people say yes. The majority of Democrats, independents, the majority of Republicans. Across the board, if you're not so concerned about individual justice, you might be worried about the fact that your tax money is not being well spent when you're thinking of 2.2 million people who are incarcerated in America today. And so I think there is an increasing bipartisan openness to alternatives.
You talked about the phenomenal number of people who are incarcerated in this country. There's even a more phenomenal number for people who are, quote, under supervision.
Yeah, I thought that parole and probation were about helping people reacclimate when they get out. But they increasingly function in a way that simply penalizes people. The average person on parole in this country has to live with something like 20 conditions. Things like, I'll never go to a bar without the approval of my probation officer. I have a curfew every single night of 9 or 10 o'clock. I'm not allowed to see people in the community who've been convicted of crimes. These are things that are very hard to live under for years and years as an adult human being.
And how many people are under supervision?
5 million, an enormous population of people. And in some states, as many as 2/3 of them cycle right back into jail and prison.
What is the incentive to land these people back into jail?
If your biggest fear is the headline of the person who gets out of prison early and then commits a violent crime, you want to be able to say, well, we were doing everything we could to control their lives and keep them under wraps, like Willie Horton, right? He was out on furlough.
It's 30 years since the campaign for president between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis.
Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
For her book, Emily was following a kid in Brooklyn who was caught in a house with a loaded, unlicensed gun and faced serious violent felony charges. But he was lucky. After months of work, he won acceptance into a diversion program where he pleaded guilty and could still serve time, but he got a year with a social worker, a year of goals and some serious restrictions to get his life back together.
One day I was in court with this young person, and the DA's office said, okay, we're ready to accept this diversion program for you. We think that you can do it. So then the prosecutor and the defense lawyer walked into the courtroom with the judge who'd been overseeing the case, and she said, I'm not doing this. You have to find another judge. The prosecutor and the defense lawyer are scurrying over the entire courthouse of Brooklyn to find a judge who's willing to let this kid take a plea bargain to this diversion program. Why did that judge refuse to take this plea deal? There was this negative story from years earlier where she had agreed to drug treatment for someone in her courtroom who had then not even committed a violent crime, but he had been accused of, like, harassing a motorist. And that bad headline had clearly spooked her from giving other people second chances. That's how we get a lot of over-incarceration. And that kind of media coverage, it's really toxic.
What do we know, if anything, about the rate of convicts in diversion programs reoffending?
It depends on the program. There are very few diversion programs for people convicted of felonies. This program in Brooklyn I was describing has a very good record, a much lower rate of rearrest and reconviction than people who go to prison and get out on the other end. Again, it's all about whether you're willing to take a risk and see someone as more than the worst thing they're accused of doing. You know, one thing that I have thought about so much as I've been following young people charged with crimes for the system, I have two teenage boys, affluent white kids, and they have a lot of capacity to make mistakes and get forgiven for them. I just see the opposite so often when I'm in court with poor kids, especially black kids, this assumption that they don't deserve a second chance or the benefit of the doubt.
Since we don't have a lot of data about whether people in diversion programs go on to commit more crimes or don't, could you tell me about the program in Honolulu?
What was happening was that people on probation in Hawaii were threatened with lots of time in prison if they failed a drug test. Probation officers just wouldn't report the first one or two or three or more violations because the punishment seemed so out of proportion to the mistake that people were making. This one particular judge came in and he realized that he was only finding out about failed drug tests like the fifth or even the tenth time that it had happened. And so what he said to the probation officers was, I want punishment to be swift and certain. And I think it can be really small as long as people know that they're going to get in trouble. And so the new rule was that if you failed a drug test, you were going to jail. Only for maybe 24 or 48 hours, but you could bank on it.
What the researchers found was that the shorter but swifter and more certain punishment was enough to compel the test subjects to pass their drug tests at far higher rates. And this has profound implications for public safety. In America, there is roughly a 40% chance that you will get away with murder. And despite the dire consequences for those who are convicted, our homicide rate remains relatively high compared to, say, Germany, England, or Switzerland, countries that don't routinely pay for a life by taking one or locking it away forever. Countries that, incidentally, also solve murder cases at far higher rates. The point here is that it's hard to catch a murderer, but it may be worth taking resources from other things to do it better.
Because if you're the shooter on the street, you can think that you'll probably get away with it, and that might make you much more likely to take a chance, even if you're facing a really heavy sentence, than someone who thinks, you know what, I'm going to get caught.
So, with limited resources, go after the murderers. One murderer is better than 100 people jumping turnstiles.
Right. Unsolved murders create this reality that people can commit terrible crimes with impunity. That's a real public safety threat.
Nonviolent crimes are low-hanging fruit. They're much easier to apprehend those people and much easier to solve. Of course, there is the argument that fewer daily crimes, jumping turnstiles and so forth, have led to the great drop in crime that we have seen in cities all across the country.
So if you think back to the 80s and 90s, there was this theory of policing and prosecution called broken windows. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that if you didn't catch every single person who sprayed graffiti or broke a window in a neighborhood, you were encouraging crime to breed there. We spent enormous amount of resources locking people up based on that theory. And in cities like New York, it really led to stop and frisk. Police are jacking people up all over the place, especially Black and brown people. And you see this very high rate of arrests. When Mayor de Blasio significantly pulled back on stop and frisk, pretty much everybody who studies this in New York and elsewhere thought, okay, well, now we're going to have to brace for a crime spike here. And that just didn't happen. New York's amazing and dramatic drop in crime, which really is like a phenomenon. I mean, New York City has right now the same kind of crime rates that it had in the 1950s for violent crime. It turns out that just does not depend on anything like a broken windows theory, and is also proven out in other cities.
According to the Human Rights Defense Center, statistically, U.S. law enforcement agencies are the worst crime solvers in the Western world, despite steady declines in the overall murder rate. Some suggest it's due in part to the long delay before DNA tests are obtained. Most suggest it's the deep distrust people in the most crime-racked places have of the police. In any case, it's a problem. Coming up, what progressive prosecutors offer in the way of solutions. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So we have a new strategy now, this new wave of prosecutors. Where did it come from?
One important force is the Black Lives Matter movement.
Emily Bazelon is the author of Charge.
It's really about police accountability in the beginning. But then some of the main thinkers and organizers think, okay, what can I do with my constituency that's really going to change this community?
As we established earlier, DAs are powerful. They set the enforcement agenda, the charges, the bail, the overall direction of criminal justice in their zones. And they're pretty much accountable to no one except the electorate.
These local organizers figured out you can get people to think about the DA as an expression of the community's values, kind of like the mayor. And if you show up, you can really control who's in office. And that realization has changed the face of the DA's office in a lot of big cities around the country in a very short amount of time. Another influence in these DA elections are donors like George Soros and the Open Philanthropy Project that have gotten in behind these reformer DA candidates. Sometimes the people who work for George Soros get involved in vetting the candidates, figuring out who could win.
Oh, so like the Koch brothers.
Yeah, well, the Koch brothers are another interesting player in this space. They have not been funding progressive candidates for district attorney, but they have funded other kinds of criminal justice reform efforts, both at universities and some diversion programs in states like Florida and Texas. And I think what you see here is a kind of libertarian, conservative recognition that the system has become too big, too expensive, and just too powerful. So this is one area in which you really do see the Kochs and the ACLU sharing some common ground.
Seems the prison industrial complex doesn't have as many fans as you may think.
You know, the program to reverse mass incarceration is not that complicated.
Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner.
For those of us who've been in the system, you stop taking so many cases, you stop convicting so many people, you stop always seeking longer and longer sentences, you stop seeking sentences of life without parole when it's inappropriate. And you also stop mass supervision, because mass supervision, meaning mass probation and parole, is a funnel that gets more and more people into jail when they violate. And sometimes those violations are real and substantial and they should be back in jail, but often it's a situation in which it's a technical violation. You know, they haven't been perfect at reporting to probation. They haven't been able to pay fines and costs. Their jobs are interfering with some of the duties, or heaven forbid, they smoked some weed once.
It is just amazing to think that a year ago I was a candidate talking about Larry Krasner and how great he was, and Kim Fox and all the great things she was doing. And that's, of course, Philadelphia and Cook County, Chicago.
Rachel Rollins is the Suffolk County, Massachusetts DA, Boston's DA, and another one of the new class of progressive prosecutors roiling the juridical waters.
And a week and a half ago, I was sitting in Larry's living room with his wife drinking wine before we were on a panel in Philadelphia, and I was texting Kim Fox Sunday night because we were supposed to be on a panel together on Monday. So we all are, you know, I don't even like the word ally anymore, Brooke, because I feel like allies are people that whisper, like, keep it up, and or send you a text, but in public don't do anything. Like,
band of sisters and a brother?
Yeah, or like, I even more seriously, like my unindicted co-conspirators.
From the outset of her campaign, she made her program clear. Deploy resources differently. Don't even bother prosecuting the lowest level crimes without getting the nod from above. Specifically 15 crimes, including trespassing, disorderly conduct, drug possession, one-time resisting arrest.
Who is the person that's coming before us? If they have mental health issues, substance use disorder, homelessness, or abject poverty, then those are the root causes overwhelmingly of maybe why they are coming into contact with the system, which right now basically says, let's arrest everyone, send them all to Suffolk County House of Corrections or Nashua Street, and it'll cost the Commonwealth $55,000 a year for them to get substance use treatment if they even get it, or mental health treatment if they even get it, or work on their homelessness, which of course they are not while they're incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, let's think about this differently and come up with a proposal. I put it in writing on my website about 6 months before the primary, and then we won. And then we won again. And then I actually memorialized it in a memo, and everyone lost their minds.
So why did everyone lose their mind?
I'm not beholden to anyone. And I happen to have an incredibly powerful role that reports to nobody. So I think they woke up on September 5th, saw that their candidate came in second, over 20 points behind me, and they said, who in the hell is this Rachel Rollins? In Massachusetts, unlike any other place in the United States of America, no arrest in a homicide can happen without the DA saying, you may arrest that person. Any detective that wants to be in the homicide unit, I have to approve that. You cannot be in my narcotics or my homicide unit on the state police side without me, the DA, approving that individual being in either unit. So I have over 400 people I'm responsible for.
And she hasn't fired a single one, unlike Philadelphia DA Krasner, who dismissed 31 lawyers, about a tenth of the legal team he inherited.
Nearly all of those 31 or so people were attorneys. These are people who are going to undermine the mission, or they had such serious problems, let me put it that way, in their records as prosecutors that we were unwilling to have them on the team.
Each prosecutor is trying to change the culture, and fast. It's the speed and the rhetoric so laden with what he deems wishful thinking that concerns Richmond County DA Michael McMahon, Staten Island's DA, who isn't seen as part of the new progressive wave.
The idea is to move forward and deal with issues thoughtfully and apply smart justice. What I disagree with sometimes is the rhetoric of people who think that you can just will away the fact that there are some crimes that are committed, that society's problems end up in the lap, really, of the police department and the prosecutor. And we have to deal with them thoughtfully and meaningfully, not in a way that just sort of magically makes everything disappear.
Last spring, the Manhattan and Brooklyn DAs came out with a new approach to marijuana prosecution.
We are going to treat it as an offense that should not be brought into the criminal justice system. And therefore, we are asking the police to issue summonses, civil summonses, or summonses not going to the Manhattan Criminal Court for those cases.
McMahon, however, took a different approach, saying, I took an oath to uphold the laws of the state of New York, and ultimately, this is an issue that should be decided in a more thoughtful and comprehensive way by the state legislature and not as a rushed reaction to the top news headlines of the day.
I do not believe that district attorneys are the legislature, right? So the legislature is considering reforming marijuana laws. That's fine. That's their job, and I will enforce the law as they get it. And what you'll also see in the majority of those cases, those who were accused of the crime are received ACDs, meaning that the cases were adjourned, contemplating dismissal, and ultimately their records were sealed.
Mm-hmm.
But when arrests are made by the police department and they're enforcing the laws that are on the books and they are keeping public order, then I support that. I do not believe that each individual county DA should become the legislature.
Meanwhile, arrests for simple marijuana possession are down over 90% in Manhattan and Brooklyn. McMahon says arrests are down in his county, too, and alternatives to incarceration are up.
I am doing reform every day in this office and fighting to do it even better. And I've totally modernized this office and its approach, but I don't issue political polemics about how I'm going to do it to sort of satisfy one group of society. We have to be honest. We have to speak truth to our issues, and society will be better off when we do that.
McMahon also has been critical of the New York State criminal justice reforms passed with April's state budget. He says the legislature is tripping over itself by trying to do too much too fast.
They eliminated bail for specific charges such as A1 possession of felony weight controlled substances. So about 3 weeks ago, the police on Staten Island arrested a gentleman who had 6 kilos of methamphetamines and thousands of dollars of cash. And obviously was someone who was trafficking these narcotics across the country. So in my mind, in that case, cash bail should be an option because that person obviously has the means and the resources to flee and not come back. And under the new legislation, we could not ask for bail in that case. So I do believe in bail reform for most misdemeanors, but some felonies that were included, I think that was inappropriate.
It doesn't do away with holding people. It does away with cash bail. If you think a person is going to flee because he had the means to do so, then he shouldn't be allowed access to cash bail. He should just be held.
I would like to hold as few people as possible.
If someone is a flight risk, they should just be held. If they aren't a flight risk, then they shouldn't be held.
In the example that I gave you, the question was whether or not someone who has that level of charges and obviously has financial wherewithal is going to be able to flee and not be returned, or if someone who is being released without some sort of holding mechanism could be back in the community without any protection to the victims of the crime is something that concerns me. So I think in a rash dash to sort of whet the appetite of those who are clamoring for criminal justice reform, they've gone too far. And I think society is going to suffer. I think public safety is going to suffer. I think victims are going to suffer.
And generally, progressive prosecutors are not incrementalists. They do dash.
There is a narrative that people want. And the narrative goes like this.
Larry Krasner.
Whenever you have a progressive DA, and that progressive DA hasn't quite cured crime yet, we are going to claim that because your policies are not draconian, something is all your fault. The fact is that since we came into office in the last 18 months, crime is flat, and violent crime overall is down 2-3%.
Philly Magazine had an opinion headline from last month, "The Disastrous Consequences of DA Larry Krasner's Reforms. Gun-related violent crime is up in Philadelphia. That was entirely predictable when we elected a district attorney whose primary goal is releasing criminals rather than prosecuting them."
Usually Philly Magazine is not the greatest offender. Actually, usually Philly Magazine is pretty friendly, but you are certainly going to find individuals and certain publications that are very much coming from the old perspective.
So gun-related violent crime isn't up in Philly, or it's not related to your policies?
Gun-related violent crime is up in Philly. It has been on a trend up for some time, but it is up. Again, mm-hmm. within the overall category of violent crime, that includes gun-related violent crime. Violent crime is down 2 to 3%. I'm looking at the results for today. The number of homicides at this time of year, the year before we were in office, was 177, and the number now is 178.
Mm-hmm.
And then by comparison, if you look at the very end of the administration of our most draconian prosecutor, Lynn Abraham, at this time of year, she was at 219. These issues are fundamentally structural issues. And the narrative doesn't want to talk about that. The narrative mm-hmm. simply wants to take whatever isolated statistic will support the proposal that sensible modern approaches don't work and push that narrative. And I'm really hoping that across the country, people will start to look at a different metric. And that metric is, what is the number of future years of incarceration that this administration is generating as compared to the past? Because the real question is not how many people are in jail today. Some of them may be in for a 10-day sentence. Some may be in serving a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. The real question is, when you aggregate the future sentencing, is it coming down? If it's coming down in meaningful, significant ways, then we will get to an end of mass incarceration, regardless of what today's headcount is in the jails.
I'm looking, for example, at Part 1 crime reported by the Boston Police Department.
On July 6th, the Boston Globe published an article about DA Rachel Rollins with the headline, "Stopping Injustice or Putting the Public at Risk? Suffolk DA Rachel Rollins Tactics Spur Pushback."
If you look at January 1 to July 14 of 2018 compared to this year, violent crime is down 9%, according to the Boston Police. But if you read anything about me at all, and the titles that the media in Boston in particular have been using, like, is she stopping injustice or putting the public at risk? Our media is not particularly diverse. They are writing through a lens of oftentimes privilege and whiteness, that they believe they fully understand these communities of color that they, of course, don't actually live in. My lens is very different. I have nieces that are in DCF custody, the Department of Children and Families, as a result of some of the decisions my siblings have made or circumstances they've found themselves in. So I come to the table with not only Harvard Business School and the U.S. Attorney's Office and a DA rotation in a very large firm, but also the sibling of incarcerated people and the guardian of two nieces due to the opioid crisis, mental health issues, and our carceral system. So there's a lot of people that say, why is she talking so much about defendants? It proves to me, when they make a statement like that, how little they know about the work we actually do. Anyone who's in the homicide unit, in the youth violent task force, or some people call it the gang unit, they understand that these are complicated people that are one day a victim, next day a defendant, possibly even a witness, and we have to treat them with dignity and respect, irrespective of what they are alleged to have done, because the system works for them as well.
We tend to assume that when the crime rate rises or falls, it's because of something the police or the court system is doing or not doing. In fact, there's so many other factors that come into play.
Emily Bazelon.
There's a sociologist at NYU named Pat Sharkey, and he did this huge study, and he found that if you add a nonprofit to a community, you can see a 1% drop in the homicide rate.
Any nonprofit?
Any good nonprofit. And when I was talking about this with Robert Sampson, who's another sociologist, he said, look, imagine a vacant lot where a group of people get together and they form an organization to turn it into a playground. You don't think of that as being about preventing shootings. But when you have a playground, you have kids outside, and then you have their parents and other people watching them. You have more foot traffic. You have the sense that this is a vibrant neighborhood where people take care of each other. You can make the community feel like a healthier place, and then it's less likely that it will be crime-ridden. Middle class and affluent people know this intuitively. This is what we want from our own neighborhoods. And yet we've somehow gotten the idea that poor people are better served by getting arrested all the time.
These are long-term problems that require long-term solutions.
Larry Krasner.
And the notion that any particular police commissioner, mayor, or DA is going to talk tough and beat their chest for a minute, and all of a sudden crime is going to stop. It's just a fiction. It's a bunch of nonsense. The reality is that the way that we make people safer is by having more money in education and less money in prisons and more money in treatment and more money in economic development and more money in job training. It's by making sure that 16-year-old young men predominantly do not feel that their lives have no value and pick up guns. That's how you do it. And no, I don't have a time machine. I can't actually go back and try to fix all the dumb that was done by this you know, predominant, prevalent philosophy of locking up everybody for as long as possible. It will take a minute, but we have a minute because we have so many people who are supportive of this notion here and around the country. We had so many people in Philly that, strangely enough, as a complete political unknown, we ended up with more votes than any DA in at least the last 20 years in an election, right? It's coming from somewhere, and it's coming from somewhere in Chicago and San Francisco a few years ago. There's 15 to 20 very important large jurisdictions that are drivers of mass incarceration, where we have progressive DAs being elected who never would have been elected 15 years ago because people have changed in how they see these things. And that was inevitable. When the other side got so good at locking everybody up, the part they were missing is that they were going to be really good at convincing not only the people who got locked up, but their mothers and cousins and friends and bosses that this system is bad. And they did that. They've convinced voters all over the country that this system is bad and that it has to change.
We just heard Krassner say that the myth of the savior crime fighter, powerful though he or she may be, is just that, a fairy tale. Saviors need communities to elect them, communities to help catch murderers, communities to ensure that murderers are rare, communities with families needlessly broken up by minimum sentencing, unreachable bail, or parole rules designed to be breached, will tend to be as leery of the criminal justice system as the system is of them. When you read the paper, check out the underlying narratives, the predictions of doom if that system changes. Fear and the alienation it spawns does not make America safer. It makes it more dangerous. It always has. This was actually the first part of a three-part series we're doing on repairing justice. Tune into our podcast extra next week for a conversation with Danielle Sered about restorative justice. You won't want to miss it. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced almost entirely this week by Leah Feder. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios, and I promise Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.